Life Audio.
Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Sports Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friend, my partner in sports radio, Barnabas Piper. Pipe, it's been a hot minute since we've done this. Lots has happened in the sports world. We have lots of stuff to talk about, but more like conceptual stuff and idea stuff, which I think is my favorite type of sports conversation to have, because by this point in the NFL year, and it's embarrassing to say it because I'm such a football person, like I'm a little bit bored and I kind of don't care. And I tend to be that way about a lot of things, but there are a lot of interesting conceptual things happening in sports and things I want to run by you. So we'll get into all of that, Pipe, right after this quick break.
Well, good day to you. It's Joel with For King Country dropping in to let you know that our brand new film, Unsung Hero, is in theaters now.
It's Luke here. We've teamed up with the creators of Jesus Revolution to bring you this adventure of a lifetime. It's a powerful, true story about a family uniting, growing in their faith, and facing the impossible together.
In theaters now, unsunghero.movie for more information.
Rated PG. Parental guidance suggested.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
All right, we're back. Pipe, one of my favorite college football coaches, Mike Leach, passed away yesterday. And I want to ask you some Mike Leach questions because I really admired him from afar. I never got a chance to meet him, but I really enjoyed studying the air raid. And when he was at Washington State, he was kind of my night game coach for a while. Like I would dial up that ESPN game at like 9:30 or 10 o'clock and watch a quarter and a half of it and just enjoy him and enjoy his offenses. And it seemed to me, and I want to hear you on this, that most college football coaches were miserable people. And by that, I mean, they had this rictus of like misery etched onto their faces at all times. Every press conference was like an exercise in presidential seriousness. And Mike Leach stood out in like sharp contrast to that, in that he seemed to have perspective, which nobody in sports has any perspective. Like youth sports, high school sports, college sports, pro sports, like literally no.
Depressingly accurate.
Yes. Like no one has any perspective on this stuff. And yet Mike Leach was like, I mean, of course he was coaching hard and he was coaching to win and he was innovative and one of the best in the business, but he seemed to understand at like an innate level that it didn't matter if Washington State beat Arizona, you know, and it allowed him to have fun with a game, which is a thing that you're supposed to do, but no one does. What are your thoughts on Mike Leach?
Yeah, I got familiar with him to some degree when he was at Texas Tech. And which was, you know, so it was kind of more of the heyday of the Big 12, you know, yeah. A lot of competitive teams there. And Texas Tech was always a bit of a doormat. And then all of a sudden there were these teams that were putting up 50 points a game. They couldn't stop anybody, but that's because they, yeah, you know, they couldn't recruit the talent. But he figured out an offense to put up 50 points a game, and it looked like no other offense. So he was.
Yeah.
He was one of those way ahead of his time innovators, a little bit like Hal Mumme back in the day at like mm-hmm. Kentucky and wherever Kentucky. It was at SMU maybe. And it was fun to watch. And like, they didn't put very many good players into the pros. So it wasn't, right. It wasn't one of those, which is part of what made it fascinating. And so I have to imagine, like, if you're a Division I football player and you play at Texas Tech, like that, those aren't bragging rights. But if you played on a Mike Leach offense, you kind of earned bragging rights because you were one of the most innovative, explosive offenses. You were putting up 50 points on Texas and A&M and Oklahoma and all these teams. And then I got familiar with him kind of before coach personality was a thing anybody paid attention to, because at that point it was like, there's a robot on the sideline who is designing plays. Do they do a good job or not?
Then
YouTube kind of blossomed, and there are these clips of him being quirky and eccentric, except what that really means is human and having a personality and
exactly,
and, you know, being interested in something other than scouting and schematics and recruiting. I remember I had a negative impression of him because I'm like, oh, the weirdo at Texas Tech. And then as I grew up, I was like, oh, he's a dude who likes people,
he's human,
and has interests and thinks about things outside of football, but also is kind of a mad scientist. So I ended up becoming a great enjoyer. I wouldn't say like a fan. I didn't follow his career closely, but in the sort of monolithic, angry, high pressure world of college football, he was a delight.
Oh, I agree. Yeah. Those press conferences were like pop art installations. Like he would do these discursive things on like candy and, you know, marital advice and the whole thing. And, he gave us Gardner Minshew, which was amazing. Like 99.9% of coaches would have like shut down the whole, you know, jean shorts, tank top, ironic mustache thing, but he embraced it. And, he just seemed like a fun guy to coach under, a fun guy to play for. Yeah. And those offenses. So the air raid was sort of the lineal child of the run and shoot in the 80s, which was also a fun offense, but Leach kind of hatched it at, he was coaching at Iowa Wesleyan, where he had no good players. And he basically was like, if I use all 52 yards worth of width of the field and I just have my receivers run to like open grass, we can move the football. Cause he had really nobody that could throw. He didn't have fast, explosive talent on the edges. And I'm fascinated by like football adapters. Like the guy at Georgia Tech was fascinating to me. He was there. He ran the triple option for
Paul
years.
Paul Johnson, was that his name?
Paul Johnson. Yeah. Yeah. You know, very ordinary looking guy, very ordinary name. And, you know, he was at this school where like, you know, the freshmen have to take trigonometry or whatever, cause it's a brainy engineering school. And yeah, he couldn't recruit all the five-star studs in the deep South. So he had to figure out a way to do it. And Leach was kind of the same way. And I always enjoy people like that. So let me ask you this. I've been thinking about this a lot lately due to something that I'm reading. What sports deaths have like hit you the hardest? Because I was truly bummed out about Mike Leach kind of all day yesterday, because I didn't realize how much I enjoyed and appreciated him.
Yeah.
And I just enjoyed him being in college football. And I especially enjoyed him being kind of close by here at Mississippi State. And the plan was always, I got to get down there and meet him somehow. And now he's gone. So like, what are some sports deaths that have like hit you at a personal level?
Yeah, it's for me, they're largely close to home. Close to my home team. So being a Minnesota fan, so Kirby Puckett is the one that hit hardest for me, because he was, and you know, we've talked about this, like for you and Walter Payton, there's just sort of like that childhood heroic status of this beloved athlete in a city that you grew up in or near. But a few years ago when Flip Saunders passed away from cancer, and that was unexpected. Like we knew he was battling cancer, and then his health took a quick downturn, and it was sudden. And that one caught me off guard, because he's a coach, because he was a good coach, but not like an amazing coach. But what he was a coach of the Timberwolves when they went from utter disaster to respectable during the Kevin Garnett era. He took them as far as any team. Yeah. He came back to the franchise after they went, you know, back in the tank post KG. and kind of re-resurrected them to stability. He was just sort of like, he was the dad in the room, and really just connected well with Minnesota fans and media. And so like they did a kind of a memorial to him before a Timberwolves game that I live streamed from my apartment in Tennessee after I moved here. And like, I was in tears watching it. And, which again, I was like, I did not expect this from that. So those are the two that come to mind off the top of my head. I'm sure there are a couple others, but those are the main ones.
Yeah, dude, for me, obviously I've talked about Walter Payton on here before and that one hit me hard, but, there was this boxer in the 90s that I really liked named Tommy Morrison. Do you remember this guy? He was a white heavyweight.
I do. I didn't follow him closely, but I remember who he was.
Yeah, I watched a lot of boxing kind of as a teenager and as a young adult. And Morrison, you know, he was this great looking, like broad shouldered, like made in a lab type of white heavyweight. And he had a big left hook and he was in Rocky V, which is a terrible movie, but he was kind of decent in it. And I enjoyed watching him. He was always on like Friday night fights on ESPN, you know, so I could watch him on like normal non-pay-per-view television. And he seemed cool. Like he was always kind of a maniac outside the ring, you know, like he lived fast and, you know, you didn't want to emulate his lifestyle, but he seemed really likable. And then I got a chance to interview him for Facing Tyson. So this would have been like 2004, 2005, somewhere around then. And then he died shortly after that. He had AIDS and he died of it, you know, kind of pretty close after I interviewed him. And I'm reading this book about him right now and it's fascinating. And one of those guys, one of those stories, you read it and you just go, I wish someone could have shared Christ with this person. And I know God's sovereign and all the right answers and stuff. And sometimes I'll encounter someone like that, like an athlete or a public figure, and I'll just think, man, I wish I could share Christ with this person, because they need Jesus more than any other single thing. And then when they die, I felt the same way about David Foster Wallace, you know, like, and I sensed in him, there was this curiosity about faith in him, and then he died and it bummed me out. Sorry, that was my phone ringing and the person hung up. So we're good.
the person was hanged up.
Yeah, exactly. But Pipe, let's take a break. And then when we come back, I want to talk about a couple of weird sports things that we're both in on. They're different things, but we're both in. Mm-hmm. We'll be back after this break.
What impacts you every day? There is one book that influences almost every aspect of our lives. Museum of the Bible reveals the Bible's impact on your favorite musicians and artists, the way we measure time, social justice, our national monuments, and more. The Bible's impact is all around you. Discover how at museumofthebible.org/impact.
Hi, everyone. If you've been injured in an accident that was not your fault, listen up. We have legal professionals standing by to answer your questions for free. Call now and find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth. Call 800-497-4410. I'm here with spokesman John Wolf. So, John, tell everyone listening who should call right now.
Well, Maria, first off, thank you for having me here. It's always nice to answer the listeners' questions. Now, as far as who should call in, anyone who's been injured in an accident and think you deserve compensation, give us a call right now. 800-497-4410. You'll find out if you have a case and how much it's potentially worth.
Thanks, John. You heard it, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity and call now. 800-497-4410.
Advertisement sponsored by Legal Help Center may not be available in all states.
All right, Piper. Somewhat incongruously, I'm in on the NBA this year, in that I've been out on it for a few years, and I'm back, and I'm really enjoying it. I got League Pass. I'm watching a lot of League Pass late at night. It's kind of my wind down thing right at the very end. And, I'm in. Where are you at in the NBA this year?
So I always kind of keep an eye on it, follow it. It tends to be a invest deeply post NFL season for me. This year is an odd one because the my investment in the NFL is a little bit more because the Vikings are winning. Granted, I don't think they're any good, but I think they're a mediocre team who is somehow winning a bunch of games. And the Timberwolves, who made a huge move in the offseason, got Rudy Gobert, were supposed to be really good, are now very mediocre. They're like a 500 team. They're lackadaisical. They're not fun to watch. And so I'm kind of stuck in the middle going, I don't have strong feelings about either of these seasons. I would like to have strong feelings about the Vikings, but that's not safe. I'm not going to do that. I would like to have strong feelings about the Timberwolves, but they're not giving me any reason to. So I'm just sort of like, and maybe that's a good thing because there's enough other stuff going on in life that I don't need to rearrange life for either of these things right now. But I'm keeping an eye on both. I'm intrigued by the NBA season. There are some surprising. It feels like the first year in a while where like anybody could win. There's 10 different potential title contenders instead of two to four. So it's definitely interesting.
It is, and the LeBron James thing is kind of winding down, which I'm ready for, and it's been fun to like hear some other players talked about and other storylines develop, and that Rudy Gobert trade is sort of turning out to be like the Russell Wilson trade of the NBA, in terms of how disastrous it looks so far, but fun season. You shared something with me via text, and that is that you've really gotten into the World Cup. And my relationship with the World Cup is my football players at Lane talk about it. So I'm with the special teams guys. So like those guys talk about it. They watch it. I've never been able to watch it. I've never cared about it. I find soccer really hard to watch. I know that's very antithetical to like the white hipster part of my personality. You're supposed to like soccer, but how did this happen for you? Like, because you don't strike me as like a traditionally soccer watching white hipster kind of dude.
No, I'm not. And there's been iterations of my soccer fandom over my lifetime. So I grew up in a family that was, this was before like anybody in America cared about the Premier League and all that. But like we were a soccer family in terms of my older brothers played it. We were at tournaments every weekend. I played it up into middle school. So like familiarity with the game, I don't know the intricacies of soccer super well, but I know how the game should work. I recognize good players and good plays and all these things. And then I used to watch it with my, when the World Cup was on, I would watch it with my brothers or my dad. It was just sort of a thing. We had a lot of friends from around the world, missionaries or people who had immigrated to the United States. So there was always interest in the international competitions. And then I got into like high school all the way up through, I'd say, my mid to late 20s. And I was like, soccer's a sissy sport. My soccer's a sissy sport era. Everybody's flopping. Everybody's the worst. It's what people do who aren't good enough to play other real sports. And somehow in the last few years, I just sort of lost my vitriol for it. And I don't watch soccer on a regular basis. Like I made it. So several weeks ago, the Vikings were playing in London and it was, so 9 a.m. start time, in America. In Central Time. And so I made some joke about like, this is going to be a real temptation during church. And a couple friends were like, it's a temptation for us every Sunday because we're Chelsea fans or we're Arsenal fans. And I was like, I still don't understand that. That's a piece I don't get. I don't know how you just pick a random English team from a city you've never been to. Like, I can understand if you've been over there and somebody was like, let's go to a Man U game and you go and you're like, oh, I'm hooked. Okay, cool.
Yeah.
But just arbitrarily picking a team, I don't know how that works. But the World Cup this year, it was a perfect conglomeration of I was in the midst of wrapping up all of my seminary work, so I'm basically working from home, reading, writing, whatever. Soccer is a high intensity sport sort of, but also very mellow for good chunks of the game. There are no commercial breaks. It's just sort of on. And so I was like, well, I'm gonna watch this. So I watched the first U.S. World Cup match against Wales, and I was just like, you know what? This was a really enjoyable experience, especially like 1:30 in the afternoon on a Tuesday or whatever it was that I was supposed to be. You know, I was in the middle of other things. And so I'm not into it in the sense that I'm scheduling my life around watching all of the matches. You know, like I missed at the time of this recording yesterday's where Argentina played, Croatia, Messi's, you know, final, you know, his trip to the World Cup finals, et cetera. So I missed that one, but I've enjoyed it a lot more than I thought. So it's not so much massive soccer fandom as just, this is a really enjoyable sporting experience that maybe I've matured into, like, oh, I can allow myself to like this instead of being like, oh, that's for hipsters and other people, and just being like, okay, this is cool. Yeah. I've also realized typical Americans, you know how during the Olympics, nobody ever watches these sports, but every 4 years, everybody becomes an expert on like backstroke technique and judging triple sow cows and whatever else. That's soccer as well, where all of a sudden people who are like, they don't watch soccer, you know, they don't watch soccer, they never talk about soccer, all of a sudden they're like, they're talking about kits and pitches and through balls and, you know, all of these things. And you're like, you sound like you're trying on someone else's language. That's what you sound.
Yeah. Like. It's like when a toddler learns a new word and then he just uses it incessantly, except in this case, the toddler is a 44-year-old white man.
Right.
No, it's kind of great to see how often do they do the World Cup? 4 years?
Every 4 years. Yeah.
Yeah. Every 4 years, like which dude in your life, like, kind of leans into the soccer thing and leans into it as a persona thing. So I have questions about the presentation of the games that I'll get to in a minute. But my first question is, has Ronnie done the performative I like soccer thing? Because that seems like it would be both like in the ether for him, but also in a weird way, like too mainstream for him to lean into.
Yeah, I feel like
what's he done with it?
I feel like he would be more along the lines of still in the sports ball crowd.
Yeah.
So still more along the lines of, you know, what's this cup everybody's talking about? What do you drink out of it? Kind of thing.
Yeah.
I feel like that would be his joke. But thus far, as far as I mean, at least what I've observed, I don't stalk his social media presence. I haven't seen him make any comments about it.
Interesting. So you mentioned they have no commercials on the telecast. That's wild to me. I literally haven't watched soccer since I was adopting my first kid from Ukraine in like 2004. I watched some soccer then, but so they've got this long sort of nobody understands how the time works in soccer.
I think in the first half. I don't think they do stop. Maybe they do stoppage time in the first half. Stoppage time is the weirdest thing to me, but yes.
Yeah. It's bizarre. Like I would really struggle with like not knowing when it was over, which is a thing that I find charming about baseball. Like baseball could go theoretically forever.
Yeah.
And I don't have a problem with that. In fact, I find it kind of charming, but I find the opposite thing to be true in watching soccer, which is like, this could go forever. This is annoying. I need some boundaries here. And so they don't cut away for commercials. How do they make money? Is it just like this entire match is brought to you by, you know, Nissan or whatever?
Yeah, there are a lot, you know, ads during halftime, there's sponsorships. It is an odd one because all of the uniforms, you know, for all the club teams, those are all sponsored teams, you know, so it's like,
right.
Whatever team has like Fly Emiratis on it and these kinds of things.
Yeah.
I don't actually know the economics of soccer, except that I know the economics are way bigger than a lot of other sports. Like when people, yesterday, Carlos Correa signed with the San Francisco Giants for 13 years and $350 million. You know, one of the largest contracts in Major League Baseball history.
Yeah.
you go look at like what Cristiano Ronaldo makes annually with whatever club he's about to alienate himself from. And it like it makes baseball contracts look cute. You know, makes football
contracts.
Kirk Cousins, you know, master businessman, has figured out how to, you know, make all this guaranteed money. Like Lionel Messi was once to pat him on the head, be like, "Oh, you're so cute, Kirk. You and your pennies." There is money there that is unlike anything else. And so that might just be because it's a billionaire's hobby, or I don't know what all. Because they're, you know, NFL games are defined by commercials. It's like, we're going to do kickoff, then we're going to go to commercial, then we're going to come back and run four plays, and then there's a punt, then we're going to go to commercial. And it's just sort of this rhythm, which allows for a lot of beer drinking. I don't know how soccer, like, they must get drunk and just be drunk enough to make it through the game, because you can't leave the game to go get more drinks during it. Because that's the scoring that will happen. The 1 7-minute stretch you went and got more beer. So
yeah,
I don't totally understand the economics.
Dude, it's fascinating too how like kind of in mass, once every 4 years, we all decide that something matters. You know what I mean? And the Olympics are sort of exhibit A of this, where like, yeah, the backstroke or curling or a thing that you don't care about at all, you're like carving out time in the day to watch it. You know, what happens in the World Cup will not stay with you. You know what I mean? Like you're primarily a Minnesota fan. And if the Vikings do the typical Vikings thing and get to the NFC championship game and blow it somehow, like that'll stay with you. You'll be bummed for a couple days over that. But like what happens in the World Cup, I'm guessing will be over for you 15 minutes after it's over, if not sooner.
It's functionally over for me now, because what I was doing was watching the U.S. team, and I'm interested in what else. I'm keeping track of it. I will probably, assuming my schedule allows it, make time to watch the final, because there is something to be said for paying attention to what matters to like 3 billion people. So, I'll pay attention to it, but I will have no emotional investment. So last Saturday, I watched the England versus France match, and see, there you go. It's match. It's not game.
And
it was exciting. It was close. You know, there was a lot of like tense back and forth. Two very good teams playing at a high level. And then the game ended, and like I didn't have any sense of like, oh, that was heartbreaking, or oh, that was whatever. It was more just like, man, that was fun. That was a fun, exhilarating competition. That's kind of how I'm at with it. So like, yeah, no emotional investment. Even when the U.S. got eliminated, I was just sort of like, well, yeah, that was bound to happen, but it was fun to watch them play.
Dude, would you say, and this is interesting because this question is kind of universal, would you say that no emotional investment but a good time is the best sports experience that you can have? Because the other options are, I'm emotionally invested for some reason and my side loses, which sucks. Or I'm emotionally invested and my side wins, but then I sort of feel sheepish for how much I cared about it. I think not being emotionally invested, but just sort of having a surprisingly great experience with sports, is the best sports thing. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it across the board, that is true. Because the thing about emotional investment is, it, at least for me, it can only be done so often. You know?
Yeah.
Like, because it's a high-risk endeavor. It's high-risk to care deeply about a team week in and week out, and then have like your mood and your entire kind of vibe rest on them. So like, even with the Vikings, I've more or less gotten to the point where I enjoy if they win. I expect them to lose. So there's a lot that the range is basically like, ah, bummer, to, oh, that was a pleasant surprise.
Yeah.
Very rarely is it like leaping out of my seat screaming, either out of outrage or joy. Because I sort of just need to protect my own psychology and emotional health.
Yeah, for sure. Yeah, you've kind of got to And this is a good middle-aged man thing, right? Because hopefully by 45 or whatever, you've learned how to govern your emotions to some degree. Yeah, and it's good to do that with things that don't matter. Pipe, let's take another quick break, and then I want to tell you about a thing in this vein, like a sports experience that I had that was kind of perfect. We'll be back in a minute. All right, Pipe, we're back. I want to talk about a fight that I watched like a week or two ago, and I know you're not a big fight guy, but there's this heavyweight, Tyson Fury. Mm-hmm. He's the 6'9 British dude, total dad bod. He's got like one of the worst pro athlete bodies I've ever seen. But he's a tremendously effective boxer. He's really hard to hit. He's great defensively. He's got a little bit of power, and he holds at least one of the heavyweight titles right now.
Is that his real name?
It is. Yeah, I believe so.
Okay, that's
and
awesome.
Somebody's going to well actually me on this, I'm sure. But I think it's his real name. His dad was a pro fighter in England, like, I don't know, 25 years ago or whatever. And yeah, he's really kind of naturally charismatic. You know how all boxers now try to do the like fake Ali charismatic thing? With Tyson Fury, like it's sort of natural for him to be in front of people. He's a showman. He's a performer. He always like grabs the microphone and sings after the fights. Anyway, I've enjoyed watching him, and I realized on a Saturday morning, it was like the last Saturday morning of college football that mattered. And I was kind of like, I'm kind of bored with this now. I'm kind of out on college football. And I realized he was fighting on ESPN Plus, which I get. And he was fighting on a non-pay-per-view card because the guy that he was fighting had 13 losses, and it was basically just like a stay warm fight for him. But the 13 loss guy that he fought was this guy named Derek Chisora, also British. And those two are like best buds. Like they're really close. And this was basically Tyson Fury just giving his friend a payday. And I was like, I'll watch that, but I'm sure the fight's going to suck, whatever. So I flip it on and they're fighting outside in a soccer stadium, one of these massive like England soccer stadiums that seats like 100,000 people, and it was cold and the stadium was full. And they fought, and they both fought really hard. Like Chisora took him 10 rounds and just taking shots, you know, he kept coming forward, never got knocked down. It was a really great action fight. But then at the end of it, these two guys like totally appreciated each other. You know what I mean? And it occurred to me that like the competitive vibe was absolutely perfect. There was none of the vitriol, none of the fake vitriol, none of the like disrespect that's sort of part and parcel now with almost every sporting event. And in fact, afterward, they like cut to the shot of them backstage or whatever, and they were eating Five Guys burgers together, and it was just kind of wholesome.
Gotta maintain that figure.
Exactly. Gotta maintain that dad bod. But I don't know. I came away from it, and of course, like my wife knows that I overthink these things and that I enjoy overthinking them. But I was trying to wax philosophical with her about what a perfect, like, you know, sporting experience it was to watch that fight. But I don't even know what I'm asking here with this, other than to share that and to say that it was great. But it's like things like that are few and far between.
Yeah,
you know what I mean.
Even so, you know, let's go back to the World Cup as sort of a comparison.
Yeah,
Americans are terrible at letting a competition be a competition. So you know, at one point the U.S. is going to play England, and like it's all Revolutionary War references.
Oh my gosh, yeah.
You know, and then it turns into World War II jokes. Because, you know, like, well, wait, we were allies then, and like, we blah, blah, blah. What we can agree on is that we hate Germany. And you're like, that's geopolitical stuff from 100 years ago. These are different realities.
Yeah.
And, you know, and they're funny enough. Like, there's some cleverness there. Yeah. But it's, there is something to be said for, like, we're not good at appreciating the competitive drive, the sort of professional competitiveness. Like I think about, like, let's take it back to the NBA. I think about like when Tim Duncan played, Tim Duncan was one of the most competitive people to ever grace an NBA floor.
Yeah.
But it showed itself in two ways. One was the way that he interacted with his teammates. The other was the excellence and the sort of like quiet ferocity with which he played. Whereas you get somebody else like Kevin Garnett was always trying to find personal reasons to be mad at the other team.
Yeah.
Which is just sort of exhausting. After I love KG. He's my favorite basketball player. Mm-hmm. But like and so what you're describing where it's just sort of there's a perfect competitiveness without vitriol, but it exhibits itself with the intensity of the competition.
Yeah.
And then the intensity is left on the playing field or in the ring or on the court. That seems to be largely gone because everything needs to be dramatized. Everything is now soap opera, WWF, WWE. I don't even know which one it is right now. Sort of like we need a backstory on this. Like, why? It's two guys trying to win. That's a whole story.
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. We don't need a backstory. We don't need to lean on like, you know, Revolutionary War references. I mean, it's really fundamentally ridiculous. And even KG, who I also was fond of, like I really enjoyed Kevin Garnett's career. But yeah, like if you take that idea and you think about it in the cold, hard light of day, it's one of the dumbest things a person can do, right? Like to manufacture this beef with somebody who at face value probably has more in common with you than almost any other person there is. It was one of the more enjoyable things about writing Facing Tyson was traveling around and realizing that all these guys who fought Tyson like actually really liked him. And it was obvious why, right? Like they all kind of had the same upbringing. They all, you know, fought for a living and they all were good at it and they had all this stuff in common. So it's like at the end of the day, it would, and they acknowledged this, right? They were like, it would be stupid for us to hate this person. And because of him, we got the biggest paydays that we ever had in our lives. And it was sort of like, yeah, that makes sense. Even though you were like trying to hit each other, there was actually some affection there. And yet to your point, yeah, every sporting event, everything has to be this like, well, Tennessee's playing Alabama and F Alabama, they're the worst. Or wait, no, F Tennessee, they're the worst. And it's just like, they're not. Like, that's a really stupid mentality.
And to make it...
And like fans... Yeah.
To make it even funnier, it's like, you know, you get... So, you know, I'm an NFC North watcher, you know, Vikings fan. And like, these two teams really don't like each other. And you think about it, you're like 97% of the players on this team weren't here 2 years ago.
Exactly.
What are they just like, do guys who wear purple inherently hate guys who wear green and gold? It is an odd thing. Cause I mean, first of all, it's the fans who have the vitriol, you know, and maybe the players sort of psych themselves into it. But like when Tennessee plays Alabama, Tennessee fans hate Alabama. Alabama fans do not care about Tennessee because up until this year, it was not competitive and so forth.
Right.
And the fans have attached themselves to this thing, but the players, I think the players, if you could like give them truth serum, they would rather focus on excellence and compete. A few of the psychotic ones need to be angry to play well.
Yeah.
Most of them need to have like what they're competing against is the fear of losing.
Yeah.
Which is
the fear of getting yelled at in films on Monday or whatever motivates you. You typically don't need the added motivation of, oh, I hate this team or I hate this person or, you know, really the only time that's present is if you've played the person before and they were an a-hole. And if that's the case, then you do probably get some juice from that. But yeah, I think most athletes would prefer to just compete and have all the ancillary people in their lives, everybody from the coach to the, you know, the fans or whoever, just keep it in perspective. But that ship has sailed so long ago. It's strange when you see it, which is why the Tyson Fury thing was so interesting to me. It was like, oh, wait a minute. These guys actually have perspective. And I don't know, I was drawn to it in ways that Yeah, you just don't see it.
Yeah.
And you don't even see it from Christian athletes, Christian parents. Forget it. I've never met anyone in sports with perspective. So it's a rare thing to find it out there in the wild.
Yeah, perspective looks like you don't care at this point. So like, you know, when
it's a tough sell.
So like when my older daughter was a swimmer for several years, this year she stepped back from it because it had reached the point where swimming was either going to be in her the entirety of her life, or she was just going to be run away from by the super competitive kids. And, you know, so it was like, it was just kind of breaking her down. So she stepped away from it to enjoy all of the rest of life, which to me looks like a decision made by somebody with perspective. And she had to deal with people on her former team calling her a quitter. Not a ton, you know, when they were like bullying her or anything like that, but there was one or two kids she knew who were like, you're a quitter. And she was like, she basically was like, Dad, am I a quitter? And I was like, no. Mm. You stopped doing something because you weighed the costs and the benefits and you said this is no longer healthy. I was like, that's how you make good decisions. Like some decisions you might regret. I said, but the other thing, as we were talking about it, I said, Grace, every athlete stops playing their sport at some point. Yep. You know, even Tom Brady is going to stop at some point, you know, probably after this year. I said, but most of us stop around your age, 17, 18 years old. Yeah. It's the end of our sports career. Some people play into college and that's the end of their sports career. Like the number gets smaller and smaller. I said, so you're making a decision now to invest in other parts of life just a year earlier than some people are forced to. And, you know, she's 17 or 16 at the time. She didn't have that perspective, But that's the dichotomy, is like a level-headed decision, trying to look at the goodness and badness of something. Is it worth it? Is it not? Versus being called a quitter because there's identity wrapped up in it. There's psychotic competitiveness. There's like, we have to find something to be angry about. It's a weird, a super weird thing. And that's in I would say that's in sort of just a niche backwater sport. It's worse when you're at the publicized sports with big like football, basketball, etc., because more people are more interested and pay more attention.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, and you mentioned Brady. It's like Brady has to be a first ballot, like no perspective Hall of Famer, I'm thinking, right?
We don't know the whole story, but he just punted his marriage to play football.
To play one terrible season under a terrible coach for a team that's given up. You know, and it's like, it's easy for me to sit here and shoot holes in it. And to your point, we don't know the whole story, but yes, it seems to be that he has punted his marriage for one more season of football. And I love football and I love playing football, but yeah, that's just tough. I mean, it's tough to see it. And yet we make heroes out of these guys, and more specifically, we make heroes out of that mentality, right? Like we make heroes out of Brady's all ball, you know, and nobody outworks him and nobody watches more film. And, you know, he sleeps on a cot in the facility, and, you know, the narratives around these things kind of become bigger than life. And the whole Jordan hyper-competitive thing that's been written and talked about ad nauseum, it's done in these sort of reverential terms, and yet your conversation with your daughter, conversations that I've tried to have with my boys, you know, we're trying to hit this balance of, if you're going to play, you need to do your best, but it's okay if you don't play. Like, it's just okay if you decide you want to do something else. That's totally fine.
Two thoughts. One is, all of this resonates with the first conversation we had on the show about a kind of respecting and remembering Mike Leach.
Yeah.
Because he was not an all ball guy. He was a human being who had interests and cared about people. And he thought about things from so many different perspectives. And maybe that's why he was never a national champion coach, and why he perpetually brought mediocre to poor programs up to interesting. But maybe that's what he loved. And he was good at it. So he is a quintessential, like, broke the mold, not all ball guy, who's beloved for it. And it totally worked. The other thing is, the second thing is, you know, you're talking about if you play, do your best, but you don't have to play. Like there, when the Bible says, whatever your hand finds to do, do it with all your might. It doesn't mean you must do everything with all your might or you have lost value. It just means like you can only do so many things. But if you're going to invest in something, do it in a way that is like you walk away with no regrets. The Lord is honored by your effort. You find joy in the doing and in the working.
Yeah.
And maybe you only do it for a year. You know, you try a sport, you take up a hobby and then you're like, that's not for me. That's okay. Did you give it what you had or did you just sort of like dink around?
Yeah, no, it's great. And, you know, even within that continuum, I think there are different ways to do it right. And actually, my wife, who is not an athlete, doesn't care about sports, doesn't even especially like sports, she's been helpful for me in this regard, in that one of my two kids is pretty anxious, you know, and he's a nervous type guy by nature. And so for him, like diving headlong into a sport is a scary thing for him. But, you know, he's played baseball and it used to kind of bother me that he wouldn't, you know, get out there and hit off a tee for an hour every night or, you know, whatever. But she was like, no, like it's really good for him just to be with his friends and take coaching from somebody who isn't you. And she pointed out like five or six really good things about him playing baseball, even though he wasn't like a traditional grinder out there, like shagging fly balls in the moonlight or whatever. And I was like, no, you know what? You're right. That's a good perspective. And it's not a zero sum game. It's not like, you know, you're Tom Brady watching 40 hours a week of film or you're a loser, you know, there are different ways to do this well. And especially for a kid, and we all know our own kids better than anybody, like the experience of him playing and being on a team was really positive, even if he didn't quote unquote, like get everything he could out of his ability, you know?
Well, and and that speaks to, like you said, it's not a zero-sum game because if sports are all about maximizing talent and winning and that is all they are about, then yeah, your son did not give it all he could. But if sports are about learning, risk-taking, relationships, overcoming fears, taking on a challenge, you have so many different things that are in terms of the development they offer to a person's character and a person's personality and all these things, then he made a great investment and probably came away with great returns because he took a step that took a lot of overcoming of fear. That's courage. Yeah. And so forth. And was on a team with guys who he never otherwise would have interacted with. And there's always a benefit in that. And
totally.
I think that when the higher the competitive level, we think about that when we put kids in T-ball. Mm-hmm. Once a kid is in like little league, we've started to lose that. Once they're in high school, we've lost it. And by the time they're in college or the pros, like a sport is for two reasons, three reasons: winning, entertainment for me, the viewer, and money. And so it is, which means it has lost its soul. There is no soul in professional sports, and which makes watching it always a little bit of an exercise in like, I kind of have to bind and gag part of my mind because I'm, you know, if I care and all of a sudden I'm like, these guys don't even care. They just, you know, they don't care. Like they go home at the end of the day. They're like, good day at work, bad day at work. And fans are like, oh, my team lost. My week is ruined. You know, players aren't like that and they probably shouldn't be. I don't know.
Yeah. And it's interesting with losing. Like sometimes it's easier to stomach when you are a part of it and you can, like, if you were on the field and you're playing and you did your level best and you feel like your team did as well, sometimes the loss is easier to take. Whereas, you know, Joe Fan 1,000 miles away on his sofa, like watching it on TV, like, yeah, he's way more angsty about it than the guy who played really hard for 3 hours and had some victories throughout the course of the game, took some L's. You know, oftentimes that person can walk off the field in a better place emotionally than the guy who's like you know, walking out of the stadium as a fan. And all of this, though, strikes me as like very fascinating stuff to be in, with our kids, in that we're trying to like set some sort of a healthy example for them as to what this looks like, not only for them now as athletes, but like in perpetuity as potential parents themselves. And there's not a lot of good examples of it out there. So it's kind of like, I have to show them how to do this right. And for so many years, I didn't do it. You know, for so many years, I was just like every other psycho sports parent, and to my shame. But I think we're doing a little better at it now. And we can end with this, but it occurs to me that most sports parents have a very narrow range of outcomes in terms of being proud of their kid. But I think the last couple of years with both of my boys in different competitive contexts, I've ended up being proud of them for different reasons, and reasons that are like surprising and good. And like, I know the Lord is in them. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like we played this Buster Bowl thing, again at Union, where, we pad up and I get to suit up with my son. And this year we played a different team, and the other team happened to be like some of the worst human beings I've ever played against in my life. They were incredibly dirty and ungracious and really kind of unfun to play against. And Tristan played really well. He had a really good game. And the thing that I was proudest of him for, though, is like not getting into a fight with these guys. You know what I mean? Because it would have been so easy for him to lose his cool. And he could be a little bit of a hothead competitively anyway. And I was like, wow, I'm really proud that you didn't stoop, you know, that you didn't lower yourself to that level. And I don't know. It's interesting and kind of the Lord to keep giving us surprising ways, I guess, to be proud of our kids.
Well, and which, you know, that's indicative of two very significant things. One is obviously Tristan's increasing maturity. You know, he's coming to this with a perspective that maybe a year or two ago he wouldn't have had, where
right.
the fight would have happened. It would have happened. He wouldn't have been able to restrain himself, yeah. Which I totally understand.
Yeah.
And the other is your perspective to recognize more about the game than playing well, losing, the other team's interactions, and sort of looking at it as the, like, there's a whole person competing here.
Yeah.
How did the whole person interact with it? And
yeah,
you know, and I'm sure like you didn't even say whether you won or lost, but like if they played that dirty, I'm assuming that they, you know, took advantage of it. Maybe they beat you guys. And like that wasn't the defining characteristic of the game. Which is,
that's really,
you know, I've seen the same thing with my kids. You know, you were talking about being a psychotic sports dad earlier. One of the ways I think the Lord looked at me when I had kids and was like, oh, this guy's a disaster waiting to happen. So I'm going to give him two girls who are interested in things that he has no interest in. That way he can't be a psycho. Like if they had played soccer, I probably would have been a psycho because I know the game a little bit. If they had played volleyball, I probably would have been a psycho because I know the game a little bit. No, swimming and dance. Two things that one of which isn't even competitive. It's just driven. And so I've been protected from it. But for that reason, I have had to learn how to interact with their drive, their competitiveness, their like pushing themselves, overcoming challenges in an entirely different way. Without, you know, you can't be a little league dance dad unless you have utterly lost your mind. Now there are dance moms out there. That's a whole other thing. In the same way that you're describing sort of coming around to it, I just started in that place where I'm like, well, I have to figure out how to be an encouragement and see what's good about this, even though dance recitals are the worst experience on earth at Christmas time and so forth.
Yeah.
It has been an exercise in refining me and in learning how to kind of be proud of, interact with them. And not just the general, like, I'm proud of you as a person, but like, I'm proud of you for it, how you interacted and did this challenging thing.
Yeah, definitely. And it's surprising how good those moments can feel, even if you don't win, or even if your daughter's not the greatest dancer of all time or whatever, you know. those things are refining, and it's not wasted motion. Pipe, it's 9 o'clock, man. We've done what we always do here, in that we've gone almost an hour. Anything you want to add on sports stuff, stuff you're reading, stuff you're enjoying before we wrap the show?
Well, on what I'm reading, I finished up a seminary semester, which means I haven't had time to do a lot of fun reading. And I'm really looking forward to, I have a bookmark about halfway through The Baseball 100 by Joe Posnanski, which I think I've talked about on here before.
Yeah, I've heard that.
Very excited to get back to it and hopefully finish it between semesters. I love Posnanski's baseball writing. He just breaks down his, as he judges it, the 100 best baseball players. With anecdotes and stats, and he's a super creative writer who makes baseball enjoyable. So I'm excited to get back to that one.
Nice, dude. I'm reading a baseball book as well right now, and it's one that I picked up for $2 at McKay's.
Nice.
It's the Keith Hernandez autobiography called I'm Keith Hernandez, which is a hat tip to
Seinfeld,
his appearances on Seinfeld. Yeah. He had like a 2-episode run on Seinfeld. And that was kind of his line. And I love a good crappy sports biography. And this one probably qualifies as that, but it's kind of well written, and it seems like he did it. And structurally it just seems like it's him, and it's like his voice, and it's kind of fun, dude. He's got a little bit of like present day broadcaster stuff in there as kind of the through line, but then he dips back into the past and tells stories. I'm having fun with it. So Keith Hernandez, if you're listening, and I know you are, I'm enjoying your book. Kind of surprisingly. Pipe, we've done what we always do on this program, in that we've wandered to and fro throughout a variety of sports topics. And until next time.
Thank you for listening to the Happy Rant Sports Podcast. Be sure to visit thehappyrant.com to check out our merchandise, learn more about upcoming live events, and listen to past episodes.
Our world can feel chaotic and uncertain, but we don't have to live enslaved to fear. Christ has promised me and you his peace, and throughout Scripture has provided powerful tools and practical steps to help us experience greater freedom. I'm Jennifer Slattery, lead host of the Faith Over Fear podcast, inviting you to join me and my team as together we learn how to starve our fears and feed our faith. Subscribe at lifeaudio.com or wherever you access podcast content.